We have here as our guest in the studio, as I said, Barbara Feis. She's professor of psychology at Syracuse University, also currently is the chair of the department. She's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois as a guest lecturer in the Pampered Chef Family Resiliency Program lecture series. She gave a talk last night and was good enough to come and spend some time with us talking about some of the work that she's done, particularly looking at the importance of rituals and routines in family life. And of course, as we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for the invitation.
To start, I thought it might be interesting to talk a little bit about the concept of resiliency as it has come to be used in psychology and family studies. And it's not exactly new, but I feel it's something that it's a word that I'm seeing more and more and hearing more and more. And I guess I understand the idea that all families have difficulties. They all experience stress. And one of the things that people who study families have looked at is that, well, given the fact that all families have stress, why is it that some of them weather that pretty well and others don't? You know, what exactly is the difference? And that's where I think more and more you see that term resilience being used.
Absolutely. And I think it's an interest in identifying family strengths that help promote families to be able to meet the challenges that they have to meet day to day, rather than focusing on what goes wrong in family life, to look more at what can go right with family life and what are the different things that families can actually do to meet these challenges. Because as you say, there's no family that doesn't have to meet some sort of adversity at some point in time, a child that doesn't behave at the dinner table, having a disagreement with your spouse. These are all parts of daily life, and there are different processes or different things that can help families sort of bounce back from some of the stresses that they've experienced.
Yeah. So I guess that then takes us to the issue of structure. Mm-hmm. What are those things that give a family and family life structure and coherence, and those things that work to bring people together as a balance to all of those other things that families are exposed to that work to do the opposite, mm-hmm. that pull them mm-hmm. apart? It's like planets, you know. There's forces that are throwing them apart, and then there's other forces that they're pulling them together. And you hope at least those two things can be in balance so everything stays together.
That's a great analogy, because there's so many forces, I think, particularly in contemporary life today, that the amount of time that we have to spend at work, the amount of activities that children are involved with, that sort of work against sometimes pulling the family together. And the kinds of work that we've been doing is looking at how some of these more predictable daily activities can help pull a family together, such as around mealtime, bedtime routines, weekend activities, and that they provide some predictability, and so that children and adults can know this is the time we're going to spend together.
Mm-hmm. What exactly is the difference between routines and rituals?
Very good question. They're not the same, but they both can co-occur in the same event. A routine is something that happens predictably. Typically, the way you communicate during a routine is very direct and instrumental. You want to get something done. Once it's over, you don't really think about it anymore. And a ritual is something that's highly symbolic. It's something that holds a lot of meaning. There's usually a lot of emotion that goes along with it. I use the example of some of you might have this experience where you're sitting at work, and about 20 minutes before you leave, your spouse or one of your kids calls and says, "We need some milk." And so you have to stop and pick up some milk on the way home. You might do this several times a week, and that's really a routine. You don't really think about it anymore. But when you get home and either you're pouring the milk for the evening meal and you sit down and everyone's together, oftentimes there's just sort of this sigh of like, finally, we've got 15 to 20 minutes to sit together. And that's more of the ritual component, because it really tells you that this is how we are as a group.
Yeah. So there, may not be exactly be clean lines between those two things.
Probably not. A lot of times a routine can develop into a ritual. So something, different sayings that people have during gatherings, different nicknames that might have started out as something that's just sort of routine and silly, then turns into a ritual and that gets repeated over and over again.
Yeah. But I guess that the one thing that is common to both of these things is that there's comfort in structure and predictability, and that's sort of the opposite of chaos. I mean, the opposite state would be you don't know what you're doing from one minute to the next. Mm-hmm. But when you know, okay, this is kind of how we do it, and then we do this and we do that, and the fact that it's predictable, it feels good. That all that stuff really is very comforting, and I'm sure lowers the stress level, if nothing else.
That might be one of the ways in which it actually works, is that through the predictability, it lowers stress levels. And there's been some research that's been done that families that practice these more predictable routines, their children are healthier. Mm-hmm. Overall, they have shorter bouts of respiratory infections. They're considered by school nurses to be just overall healthier. And so there may be some component that actually reduces stress and some of the physiological tolls. We don't really know this yet for sure, but that's one speculation. Mm-hmm. And then the other part of it, though, is that when it's predictable and you're gathered together, it provides you that feeling of security, too, which we know is so important. So it's the combination of the predictability and then that felt security and belonging to this group that's sort of larger than yourself.
Yeah. Well, I think that's interesting that there is apparently at least some evidence to show that not only does that have an emotional kind of component, and that kids in families that do have that kind of structure and those kinds of routines do, their anxiety level is less, you know, mm-hmm. By those kinds of measures, but that you can actually, at least some people would make the argument that say, not only are kids emotionally more healthy, but they're actually physically mm-hmm. more healthy.
I would think so. I think just reducing the overall stress, and we know anyone who has kids knows that they look for structure and they really mm-hmm. benefit from structure. They might not want it sometimes, you know, particularly towards adolescence, but if you can have this structure repeated over time, it gives them sort of a roadmap. They know what to expect. And so it would seem logical that then reduces your overall stress level.
Maybe I should just very quickly introduce again our guest, Barbara Feese. She's professor and chair in the Department of Psychology at Syracuse University. And this particular thing here we're talking about, family rituals, routines, how that kind of structure makes for a healthier family and family life, something that she's spent a lot of her time, professionally speaking, doing writing and research about. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, certainly we know that family life over the last few decades has changed a lot. We have more and more families where both parents work, and we have kids that are involved in a lot of activities. School is very demanding, but they're doing a lot of other extracurricular activities, maybe sports, maybe some kind of artistic pursuit, all kinds of things. Everybody is very busy. And it seems that one of the things that has been lost, at least if you ask families about what their experience is, it seems that families are spending less time at the family table eating together. Because, who knows, people are working, they're doing other sorts of things. Kids have to go to soccer and to various kinds of events. And it seems very difficult to find the time to get everybody to sit down together for a meal.
Yes and no. There's some inconsistencies in the data around family meals and how often people actually sit and eat together. There has been a decrease in the overall amount of time. But I guess the question is, how much time do you really need for there to be some sort of effect? And there was a recent poll by the Christian Science Monitor that reported that families with school-age children, 77% of the time, regularly or frequently eat dinner together. And these don't need to be elaborate gatherings. In fact, they usually last about 20 minutes. So if you think about, take a conservative estimate of a family eating dinner together 3 or 4 times a week at 20 minutes a pop, then we're talking about 90 minutes or the equivalent of three situation comedy shows on television that may have a very powerful effect on families. So it probably is true that we're not eating together seven nights a week and we're not eating at exactly 5:30, you know, in the afternoon, but most families with school-aged children find a way to get together 3 to 4 times a week, and that may be enough predictability to sort of have these effects.
Mm. Well, and also you'd have to say that there's nothing magical about sitting down at the same table and everybody eating together. It's also how it is you spend that time. What are you doing there besides putting food in your mouth at that time that you're all sitting down?
Oh, absolutely. And these meals, as I said, they're relatively short in time. They're only about 20 minutes. But in the observations that we do, we see that there is so much going on during that time. There are things that have to do with assigning roles and problem solving and learning how to communicate and examples for manners. You know, what's accepted in my family versus what's accepted in somebody else's family. Vocabulary building, all sorts of things happen in this really brief period. And if it's conducted in a way so that there's a lot of responsiveness among members rather than trying to cut them off, then just by the very fact it's repeated over time, it can have an effect.
Yeah. As we talked about a little bit earlier, obviously all families are going to have tensions and stress and difficulty. How do you try to keep conflict from coming and having dinner with you?
Excellent question. One of the things that we try to tell families is that if you're going to have a marital fight, don't have it at the dinner table. This is not a good time or place to air some of the whatever conflict you might have had in the morning before you left for work or when you just got home. There's going to be conflict, you know, and disagreements, those sorts of things. And it actually gives you an opportunity to sort of right then and there problem solve. How are we going to resolve this conflict rather than letting it get escalate out? Because that's when it can be really harmful and people are leaving the table and they're upset and they're angry and the doors are slamming. And that's obviously not a very healthy kind of gathering. But I think particularly where there is a mother and a father at the table, that's not the best time to work out problems in your own relationship. It's really more of a time to talk about what's going on either with the kids at school or other family members or different kinds of activities that they're involved in.
Well, and of course, there's also the potential to have some kind of fight erupt between the children at the table. So I guess I'm thinking, so how do you actually make some kind of rule that says, now look, if we've got some problem, we need to settle that and we will do that. But right here for this 20 minute segment, we're going to say, you know, we're not going to do that. No cross word will be spoken. And I imagine there are some people actually do have that rule. They say, no, we're not, you know, you've got to be civil. Don't reach out and whack your sibling, you know, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. We're just, for this time, let's just not do that.
Yeah. There's some families that say this is time out. We're not going to do this here. We're going to do this later after dinner or after ice cream or whatever. There are other families, though, that sometimes they will have what they refer to as sort of like their problem night. Not to bring up the problems, but everyone can come to the table with one thing that's been bothering them or one problem that they might be having with another family member. And that way it's sort of planned ahead of time so you don't get all the heat of the moment kind of argument and say, you know, I really am tired of my sister coming into my closet every day and taking my clothes without asking me. So rather than have that big argument, you know, in the morning when you're getting ready to go to school, you have, okay, this is our problem night, Thursday night's problem night. We're going to solve a couple of problems in the family.
Hmm. We have a caller here, and let's bring them into the conversation. I think on line number one right here. I'm not sure of the town. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm calling from Champaign.
Yeah, okay.
I had a question for Dr. Fies. I was just curious whether you thought there was anything unique or especially important about the dinner time ritual that distinguished it from other family rituals, if it made some special contribution to family resiliency.
It's the one that's probably been studied the most. And it's the one that, as a researcher, it allows us to actually watch people eat dinner together and get a good sense of what's going on. But I don't think those are the only rituals. In interviews that we've done with families, one of the things that we've noted is that each family sort of has their own unique set of rituals. And it might be certain celebrations around the child's first haircut. It might be going to a certain vacation spot every year. It might be certain sports activities that they've built a lot of routines around. So I'm not sure that dinner time is the only predictable routine and ritual that can have a powerful effect in terms of family resilience, but it's the one that's probably been studied the most.
Yeah, I was mainly wondering if there was something you thought maybe that was specially important about dinner time ritual, so that, you know, it might be, say, particularly important not to lose it or not to diminish it, if it makes some special contribution. In your observation?
Well, we do know that it does make some special contributions, and they're sort of heavily packed events, and that there's so much that goes on in terms of a routine dinner time. There are things about learning how to control behavior. There are family stories that crop up about family members that maybe aren't even living anymore, that provides, you know, generational connections. It's also a time as children get towards adolescence to begin to sort of develop their own sense of autonomy. So in terms of a setting that is packed with so much in a relatively short period of time, I think there may be something unique about it. But there may be also some other rituals that provide some of those same elements.
Okay, because we didn't hear, I guess, last night much about family stories, but I understand that's also a particular interest of yours.
Actually, it is, and we hear some of these family stories at the dinner table, and the idea is that families share these stories about other family members, and it's a way to sort of provide lessons and values for the next generation, as well as to expose them to other members of the family and kind of learn the lessons that those older members might have learned as they were growing up.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another caller here. This is line number 2, and I believe the caller's in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I had 2 comments more than questions. I wanted to comment that single parenting is another definition of family that should be brought into this discussion, because single parents like myself have a tendency sometimes to, you know, we're so busy, we just put the kid at the table and go do other things while they're having a meal. So I've had to make a great effort to sit with my child at dinner time and talk and do all the things that you've just been talking about. But also, as a single parent, I like to listen to the evening news on the television, and just so happens that it coincides with dinner time sometime. And so I have to make myself turn the television off and focus on what my child is saying. It's a challenge, because sometimes I'm really interested in a news story, or, you know, the phone may ring, and it just takes a lot on my part as a parent to role model for my child and just turn everything off, sit with her, eat, and hear what she has to say. That's my comment.
You know, I think you're really bringing up an important point in the families that we've looked at, and other families too, is not to equate sort of family meal times with a particular family structure, that is a mother and a father and mm-hmm. 2.5 children, because that's just not the true nature of American families. And the research that's been done with single parent families is, you know, very, very consistent with what you're talking about. There's a lot that you have to handle and a lot that you have to do on your own. Interestingly, families with single parents, they tend to engage in a lot more conversations with their children, that there's a less of sort of, it really is an opportunity to find out what your child is doing, and really allows for some very good conversation. I know it's hard to cut that 15 minutes out of the news shows,
yeah.
but when you can,
yeah.
It may actually be a very unique kind of relationship, and have some opportunities that maybe you don't see in, you know, either larger families or families where there are multiple adults sort of competing for the table.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. We are talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Barbara Feast. She's professor and chair in the Department of Psychology at Syracuse University. And this whole subject of family ritual and routine is something that she's written a lot about and looked at in her research and looked at other people's research. She's here visiting the campus. She's here as a guest of the Pampered Chef Family Resiliency Program, here to give a lecture. She talked last night and was good enough to come and spend some time with us. What I want to do is take a second here because, you know, maybe one of the things that your life is organized around is listening to the radio station, or at least at certain times of the day, you're going to be turning it on. I certainly know that that's true with me. What we hope is that you would not take this radio station for granted, because we are here in large part due to the support. It's made possible by the support of people who listen. Now, it's true that we have gotten funding in the past from the federal government and the state government, but that hasn't really kept pace with costs. And certainly, you know about the kind of budget difficulties that the state of Illinois, just like other states, have had in the last couple of years. That's been meant big cuts for the university, and that has come down to us. So what we're trying to do is keep this station strong and maintain the program service that you value. And we do that a couple of times by reminding you just how important your financial contributions are. What we'd like you to do right now is to pick up the telephone and make a call, not a call to the show, but a call to our pledge number, which is 244-9455. We have some volunteers there who have given some of their morning so they can take the call. It will not take more than a moment or two, and that's very important to this radio station. I'm thinking that Jack Brighton is standing by in Pledge Central.
Yes, indeed.
He is a former producer of the show, and right now he's the head of our internet operations, the guy who's maintaining our website.
Producer emeritus.
That's what we like to say,
exactly.
Producer emeritus, with all the privileges and rights that adhere thereto.
That's right.
Which ain't much.
Every year I get another word added to my job title. I love that. Listen, I did want to say that we have had an outstanding morning as far as generating listener support. We have raised more than $57,000 as of this morning on day four of our spring campaign. So we're over one-third of the way to the goal for this week, which is $160,000 in listener support. These callers helped us exceed our goal of 60 pledges by 10 a.m. this morning. Bradford, Allward, and Mowiqua, the K Ranch in Prophetstown, Richard Hyatt, not sure what town, Bill Keller in Humboldt, and Alan Daniel of the A.C. Daniel Farm in Westville. So thank you so much for pledging your support for the station. It's raining outside. It's a great time right now to go to your phone and make a pledge. All you have to do is call us, 217-244-9455. We accept Visa, MasterCard, Discover, American Express, or if you're a U of I staff member, you can have a payroll deduction arrangement made. A lot of companies do matching pledges, so if you make a contribution of, say, the basic membership of $40 per year, your company will match that, and that obviously helps a great deal. And one other thing to mention, David, while you're on the way to the phone to dial 244-9455, we have someone who called in who loves Focus 580, has pledged to double last year's contribution. If 10 new or lapsed members of Friends of WILL will call in with a pledge by noon today on Focus 580. So that would yield an additional $250 if we get 10 new pledges from people who have never pledged or who have lapsed and are returning to the Friends of WILL by noon. That will make a big difference. So please do make that call right now, 217-244-9455.
Okay, thank you very much, Jack. We'll check back with you at the end of the first hour of the show. Let me again introduce our guest, Barbara Feese. She is a professor of psychology at Syracuse University. She's also the department chair there. And we're talking about family rituals and routines. Questions and comments are welcome, as always, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers for the program. You will come right here to the show. No one will waylay you and expect you to pledge. Of course, that would be nice, but it's not required for calling into the show. The mealtime itself, we've been talking about the mealtime as a kind of a thing that gives families the opportunities to be together and maybe have some quality time. But there are certain stresses and conflicts that center just right around the very event. Everything from getting everybody there to getting everybody to sort of behave themselves to conflict over what it is we're having. Those people say, no, I don't want this and I don't want that. And for mom or dad or whoever is trying to put the meal on the table, it's difficult enough without having to cater to everybody's whims. Last night, my wife and I were sitting down to dinner, and she was talking about how when she was a kid, and that happened, her father's stock phrase was, "Your mother is not a short order cook." So that was kind of, and actually, Celeste, my wife said, "Well, actually, she kind of was a short order cook." What sort of how do you address those potentials for conflict, and maybe even get the children involved in the whole? Maybe that's the key to actually get them involved, not just as consumers of the meal, but also as producers of the meal.
Yeah, I think if you can get them involved, even starting at a very early age, if you think about it, a lot of sort of finicky eating starts around the two, three-year-old sort of age, and there are four major food groups: Cheerios, yogurt, hot dogs, and I can't remember. I think the fourth one is free to personal preference. And you know, the more that you can get children involved in, you know, very, you know, simple things like helping to set the table when they're old enough to be able to do that, picking out. Being responsible for coming up with the menu for one meal a week, and then they can't complain because they chose the menu. It doesn't have to be elaborate, and I think that's really the point. You don't need to have candlesticks on the table. It doesn't have to be, you know, freshly pressed linen. These are things that can happen, you know, fairly with not a lot of fuss, because I think if there's a lot of fuss involved, then it also increases the likelihood that there's going to be a lot of conflict and probably disappointment and disagreement about what should be going on.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone else. We have a caller in Gibson City, line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello. Mm-hmm. Yes, well, I guess sometimes you think of all the things you don't do right with your children, and we have three adult children. And the one thing we did was, well, I did try to have everybody at the same meal, even if it meant fluctuating the time, if that was possible. Of course, I work too, but when we sat together, we could talk about just about anything. Not family arguments, of course, you know, that wasn't, but anything, and we were medical people, so it got pretty gross. So when we had family guests, we would really have to be careful what we talked about, because it wouldn't be appealing to other people. But we found it, now that we have adult children, that was a very healthy thing for us to have done. And even when they were little, one of the things, too, about being a short-order cook, I got so that I don't like this. Well, what we ended up doing was having peanut butter and jelly on hand and a can of soup, and if they didn't like what we had, they were welcome at the appropriate age to, you know, to have peanut butter and jelly or heat up a can of soup or whatever they could make themselves, they were allowed to have if they didn't like what we had at the dinner table. And it's been very interesting, and I'm enjoying listening to our guest.
That may be the best way to deal with that thing. That here's the entree, and if you don't like it, we will offer you one alternative. You can go and you can make a peanut butter and jelly, or I will make you peanut butter and jelly. But we're going to draw the line at being able to place special orders.
Yeah, and I think, too, the caller just brings up really an important part about family resilience. There are a lot of things that are pulling against you, either work commitments and other things. And if you're able to carve that 15, 20 minutes out of your day, it does provide a lot of opportunities for conversation. And every family finds their own unique way to do it. There's not a cookbook for this. And, you know, some families might have very gory discussions at the dinner table given their own. You know, if you're working in a medical field or other fields, some families have very heated political discussions. Families with young children often have discussions that revolve around different kinds of jokes, around different body parts and body functions. So, you know, it really depends on sort of what stage of life your family's at and then what's the unique characteristic of your own family.
Yeah. We were talking a little bit earlier about how some families actually do use this as an opportunity to talk out problems. Mm-hmm. And they'd say, okay, mm-hmm. This is Thursday night. Is our problem line. Mm-hmm. So people are going to be coming to the table with problems. And so that would mean that parent or parents are going to be in the position of being facilitator, moderator for these discussions. How do you do that to actually make this be productive and try to also, though, minimize the potential for for conflict, for fights, for hurt feelings, for misunderstandings. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of possibilities for this not to go well.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why the rules have to be set up ahead of time. It can't be a free-for-all, and it can't be a complaining session. And so that if the rules are set up ahead of time, you know, you get to bring one problem only. You can't say anything that's hurtful about another person. And that the goal of the discussion is to work on solving the problem, not to bring up dirty laundry, not to, you know, throw in the kitchen sink and have that kind of argument. And if the moderator or the parent feels that it's getting to be, you know, too much, then it's time to call it off. But typically, really, kids can help you create what they want, what those rules would be, because they're very sensitive. They don't want to have their feelings hurt either. And so they can, if they're a part of making those decisions about how this is going to work, then it can go more smoothly.
Mm-hmm. I was going to launch into a question, but I see we have another caller. So we'll do that in Urbana, line number one.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Can you give us some suggestions for a calming bedtime routine, something that would help people settle down and be ready for bed?
Well, I suppose it really sort of depends on the kid. Certainly depending on their age, preschool, early school age children often like, you know, a bedtime story type of routine. Some families that we've talked to, they have a song that they sing every night. Sometimes it involves children picking out a favorite stuffed animal or something that they want to sleep with. You know, a lot of times they sort of develop out of their own, and you sort of see, oh, I've been doing this over and over again, and getting the child involved typically helps calming a little bit. The other part of that is making sure there's an end to that bedtime routine, too, because sometimes if it goes on too long, if you're a parent dealing with a child who needs to go to sleep and not just have one story after another, there needs to be some sort of, you know, recognizable end to it as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks. That bedtime is another one of these potential times for conflict. Mm-hmm. How critical do you think, or is it critical, do you think that there is a regular bedtime and that's so that's not something that you have to negotiate every night? But when is the time to be in bed, and when is the time then for the light to go off and for mom and dad and give you a little whatever, and then they're gone?
From the families we've talked to, there's a lot of variability in this, and some families really have an exact set time, you know, not a minute later, not a minute earlier even to go to bed. And it seems that if you can find a good window of time within not hours flexibility, but, you know, a regular bedtime that the child can expect, and then to build those routines around it, whether it's, you know, they have their bath before they go to bed, or if there's a certain kind of thing that they like to do, sing a song or something that's calming, not watching a lot of television or playing a video game right before you go to bed. And then probably the hardest part for parents is to be able to walk out of the room and say, you're going to bed now. You know, sometimes going to bed can be sort of a scary process, particularly for young children, because they're sort of like between that wake and sleep world, and they need some reassurance. And you don't want the battles to be over what time you're going to bed. You want to make that as smooth a transition as possible.
Maybe we might talk a little bit about rituals. Back at the beginning of the conversation, I asked you to talk about the difference, and it is clear that there's a little bit of blurring in between those two areas, and yet rituals do have a kind of emotional significance, probably, that routines really don't. And that they surround special occasions. It may be religious holidays. It may be birthdays. It can also be, you know, anniversaries of people's passing. It can be around weddings. All of the major posts during the person's life have opportunities for rituals to be connected with them. And obviously for a lot of people, it's something, again, that's very important. It's a source of comfort. It allows them to make contact with family, sometimes with family that aren't aren't there physically anymore. That also seems to be something that it gets a little bit more difficult across time to do, partly because families, as we all get up and grow up and go off and people start their own families, they're also so spread out. And of course, then if this is something that only happens once or twice a year, then that puts a great deal of pressure on that event and that time and everybody. And that, you know, may be why it is that people feel that those kinds of gatherings are so stressful. And that and they say, you know, at Christmas time, Thanksgiving, whatever it is, I'm not going. I'm not going to do that because it gets so difficult.
Yeah, I think particularly around what you just mentioned, the sort of the high point rituals that have not only do they have family obligations, but when you lay on top of that sort of the materialistic parts of obligations around, particularly around the holiday season, then the ritual really turns into a dread. And that if people can begin to identify what is the part that you really dread about this gathering and what is the part that you really look forward to. The part that you look forward to is the ritual. The part that you dread is sort of the obligation that has been imposed on you for whatever reason, and it sometimes gets in the way of being able to enjoy the ritual. So if you can sort of identify if there are different parts of it and if there's any way possible not to do or pay as much time to the parts that you dread, then usually it can be a little bit happier. These are times of heightened emotion that can give you some very positive feelings. But as you bring up, they're times of heightened emotion. And they are so full of different symbols, that some of them that have been passed down across generations, that we don't even always recognize it. I mean, some of your listeners might think about when they're preparing a Thanksgiving meal and one person decides that they want to bring the pumpkin pie that year, which means that how are you going to tell Aunt Sally she's not bringing the pumpkin pie, and who are you to think that you can bring? And all of a sudden, it turns into this great big discussion, and it's all about pumpkin pie. But it's really not about pumpkin pie. It's really about your place in the family. It's your role in the family, and it might reflect some different tensions that are going on. So it's those little things that we think are sort of inconsequential that oftentimes get kind of blown up in these rituals. Events because they are so emotional.
Yeah. And it is funny and sometimes not so funny just how much family dynamics, relations between siblings and between parents and children, doesn't change. It doesn't matter how old you are. When you all get together, you know, somebody's still the parent, somebody's still the child, somebody's still the big sister, big brother, you know, all that kind of stuff that you'd think, well, you know, everybody now is over 50, okay? We don't have to do that anymore. And yet, when you get together, you're still doing the same stuff.
It's pretty entrenched. I mean, it's hard. I guess on the one hand, the things that really have the positive aspects of a ritual, that they repeat it over time, they're predictable, is also the other part is that when it's repeated over time, it's hard to break out of some of those patterns. And as you say, even though individual members are aging, the family itself sort of stays in the same structure. I mean, how many 25 to 30-year-olds are still sitting at the kids' table, because there's no room at the adult table yet. So they're hard to change.
Well, and going back to routines, and we talked about how you can structure those routines and how those can be good opportunities to bring families together around such mundane daily events as dinner and bedtime. How are those two things connected? And do you lay in the way that you structure your family routines, those sort of mundane daily life things, is there a connection between that and how these more emotionally loaded things are structured? And is there some relationship between those things that all also is going to extend as kids get older and everybody becomes an adult?
Well, I guess two things. One is that it can affect kids as they become adults, because oftentimes we practice the same routines and rituals that we were raised with, mm-hmm. which presents interesting opportunities when you think about bringing two different sets of traditions and rituals together. Sometimes they meld quite well. Sometimes there's a need to negotiate. And sometimes there's a need just to create something totally new that maybe you weren't very happy with how your routines and your rituals were when you were growing up. The other part of it is that thread just sort of continues, and it starts, you know, oftentimes with some very mundane sort of comment or activity that then comes to signify sort of your role in the family and what your family means. I give the example many times about a family that had very lengthy discussion about whether they liked jelly on their peanut butter and jelly sandwiches or not. And it turned out that the father and the older daughter liked jelly on the sandwich, and the mother and the younger daughter did not. And the father and the older daughter were the cut-ups and the jokesters in the family, and the mother and the younger daughter were sort of the organizers. They got things done. And they had the whole neighborhood categorized by who liked jelly on their sandwich and who didn't. But it was a symbol to them that that was their shorthand of communication. It was like, who are the jokesters and who's going to get the work done? And it all came down to peanut butter and jelly.
Oh, I like that story a lot. Let's talk to somebody here in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I have a comment and a question. My comment, I was not able to hear your guest last night. I'm sorry I couldn't. But the question, I'm a grandparent, obviously, and I think grandparents present both joy and pain because we have lots to offer grandparents, but we excite kids, especially when their parents are away. So could you, your guest comment on that? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Great opportunity to talk about grandparents. Grandparents can be very supportive in participating in different rituals with their grandchildren. One of the things that we've looked at quite a bit is just the act of storytelling and grandparents telling stories to their grandchildren, not only about the grandparents' experiences when they were growing up, but also stories about their own children who are the parents of these kids. And kids really like to hear those kinds of stories. And it provides them a connection across generations and sort of gives them a sense of identity for their own family.
Since we mentioned this, I do want to mention a book that you edited along with another author and that deals with this very subject. Mm-hmm. And the title of the book is Family Stories and the Life Course Across Time and Generations. The other editor is Michael Pratt. And it's a collection of essays by different writers about this very sort of thing, about just how important family stories are. And I presume there we're talking about their stories about family members and their lives and things that happened in the past and, you know, the carrying on these sorts of things, making sure that, that people live on in the family through these stories, even though they're not there anymore. And something that I wonder really whether we actually haven't gotten away from.
Possibly. We don't have any really good data about how often this happens. The book presents several different studies that have been done that were either in naturalistic settings or in more experimental settings, just to have people tell stories, some of their family stories, to either children or just recount what they learned about. And as the last caller brought up, one of the authors talks about stories that grandparents tell, which may have very sort of powerful messages about morals and values, and listening to your grandparents in a way that you can't always listen to your parents. So I'm not sure how frequently this always happens. I was very surprised in a study that we did in that parents of infants said that they talked about some of their own childhood experiences, you know, several times a week. And it didn't make any sense to me because the infants couldn't understand.
They were talking about their childhood to
their
babies.
To the babies. Oh. And I thought, this doesn't make any sense. These babies don't understand it. And when we talked to them, what happened is they said, you know, I'd be bathing, you know, my new baby, and I would think about my own grandmother, and I would tell a story about my grandmother. Or they'd be in some sort of gathering with her own mother, and her mother would say, well, you think that this baby is fussy. You should have seen you when you were a baby and tell tell a story. So that sort of this whole act of being a parent and going through the different stages often evokes sort of these memories that you had that are often sort of stored as a story and then told again.
Yeah, well, that's sort of the way the memories are. There's, you know, who knows how much stuff there is that's there. You just need the right thing, the right trigger to have it come back.
Right.
But I think that's really interesting. Yeah. The parent telling the story to the baby, and of course the baby's not going to get it. So then you really wonder, well, who's really, am I actually telling the story to myself? Or do you not even think about that?
Probably don't even think about it. Because I think it's when the children get older, a lot of times parents will use these stories to sort of get through some difficult times. Mm-hmm. So like if you're having troubles with your brother or your sister, or you're having trouble with your peers at school, or you have a difficult teacher, you know, say, well, you know, when I was your age, I had this kind of experience. And sometimes that allows the child to kind of see, oh, well, maybe I'm not the only one. But it's also easier for them to understand because they can sort of play it back in their memory again and say, oh, well, they did this, this, and this during that experience.
And that's also interesting because I can well imagine that when parent goes into that kind of mode, there's going to be a lot of eye rolling. And kids are going to think, oh, yeah, okay, here it goes. What was it like when you were a kid? But you may get some of that, and maybe you have to put up with that. But on the other hand, maybe you're also going to think, okay, but they are hearing the story. Now, maybe I'm going to get a little static here about here. Oh, here goes Dad again about how he mm-hmm. how he walked 5 miles to school in the snow barefoot uphill. But
that father was in one of our studies. I heard that story.
Really? Funny thing. I think that was my dad. Funny thing about that. But maybe at the same time you might get that kind of thing. But can you then also hope that they are also hearing the story and that it's going to register with them somehow? And so the point that you're trying to get across, really, you actually will get the point across. It may not be obvious.
It may not be obvious, and it may not be the point you were trying to get across either.
Oh, well, there's another thing. You know, watch out for unintended consequences,
right.
I guess. We're coming down to the point here. We have a couple of minutes left. Maybe going back to the sort of routine issue, we talked a little bit because a caller called and asked the question about bedtime. We talked a little bit about that. Mostly we talked about the idea of mealtime. Are there other sorts of things, other activities that you can use in that same way that have those sort of that same sort of function and feature?
Well, a lot of families spend a considerable amount of time in the car these days, going from one activity to another. And those can actually turn into routines and rituals, so that there might be a special ice cream store that you stop at after a performance. That these are things that happen on a regular basis. So actually some driving routines and driving rituals going from one event to another can happen. Getting ready to go to school, how you say hello, how you say goodbye, can also be considered routines and rituals. And then, of course, there are different points throughout the year, such as you mentioned earlier, anniversaries, birthdays, vacations, weekend activities can all fit into this mold.
Do you find people into, I think some of these things are they're kind of unintentional. I mean, mealtime happens and bedtime happens, and so do major holidays happen. Do you find that people are intentionally creating these things? They're not taking advantages of existing rituals or things that have kind of been handed to them because that's what in our family we've always done, or that's what everybody does, but that people are on purpose saying, we need a ritual to commemorate a certain thing. One doesn't exist, so we're going to make one up.
I've seen that probably not as much as you would expect, although I think it does happen. A couple of examples is that how families create rituals around the death of a pet, because this is often the first time the child has experienced death, and that seems to be something that's important for a lot of families. I've also seen cases where families have unbirthday parties where the child gets to pick their unbirthday day of the year and have, you know, sort of a mini celebration, not gifts or anything. So I think that there are some cases where families say, you know, I would really like to do it. And the important thing is that they come up with the ritual that makes sense for their family and is not something that you just get out of a cookbook.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
For talking with us. Our guest this morning, Barbara Feese, she is professor of psychology and chair of the Department of Psychology, Syracuse University. She's here visiting the campus. Her visit sponsored by the Pampered Chef Family Resiliency Program. She gave talk last